Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Tuesday, October 29th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour and 5 hour and 10 minutes or so. We'll go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to be with me as we talk about five different sports betting markets here on today's show. We'll start with Brian Blessing, the host of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. We'll do NFL, NHL, and some golf with Brian. Then in the second half of today's show, professional handicapper Rolf Michaels will join us from WagerTalk.com. We'll talk college basketball, college football, and finish up in the NFL with him. Over at BangTheBook.com, we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. Lots of great stuff across those five sports betting markets, plus Major League Baseball, the NBA, a lot of stuff coming your way for NASCAR this weekend, UFC this weekend. We had a good tennis preview from Big Ten Watto for the Paris Masters. We'll have some soccer previews later on in the week to go along with some esports stuff as well for the League of Legends World Championships. So plenty of stuff going on over at BangTheBook.com. Check out our Bang the Book YouTube page. And of course, if you miss any editions of Bang the Book Radio, all archived over there at the website, and you can find them wherever it is you get your podcast content. As you know, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook, BTB, and the number 200 is that promo code. 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook, 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. Two guests on the program here today. We start things off with our chilly leadoff hitter. That is Brian Blessing of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. Brian, how's it going today, man?
Yeah, man, you nailed that. It's 41 as we speak, and I do my stuff out on the patio in the shade, so it's probably about 30. And which, you know, I mean, a guy that came here from Buffalo, you think would be great, but I am such a baby now. I am so bundled up. I mean, you would think I'm climbing the Himalayas.
Well, I'm sure things will warm up for you. And I saw that Denver getting pelted with snow again. A lot of places dealing with snow here already.
Yeah, that's their problem.
Yeah, right. That'll be coming my way on Saturday where we get our first snowflakes of the year. So definitely not looking forward to that. But I am looking forward to week 9, mostly because I went 0-5 in the Super Contest and the Circa Million in week 8. So looking forward to turning the page here and hopefully getting some better games. But as far as week 8 goes, Brian, as we kind of put that to rest a little bit, what were some of your takeaways from this past weekend?
Oh, the Bears field goal kicking, you know, those woes continue. Denver playing not to lose, which, you know, sounds like Monday morning quarterbacking, but you know, I know Flacco's not Brady, but we're watching the game. In fact, I was standing there watching it with Matt Youmans, and it was 3rd and 5, and they're like at the 45 coming in, 3rd and 5. And I said, they're going to run it into the pile and burn a time. They're worried about the timeouts. Get the first down and the game's over. I know Flacco's not Brady. You know, win the game. And, of course, they punt, personal foul on a tackle, kick lose. I don't know. Coaches, the way they manage these games. Absolutely infuriating to me. These guys work 18-hour days, but when they're on the sidelines, they can't look 15 seconds into the future. The way these games are managed is insanity. I mean, we can whine about the refs all we want. The coaches are tried and true.
Yeah, that's the thing, man. I mean, so many of these guys are just playing not to lose. And I mean, the last thing you want to do in 2019 is put it in the hands, or I guess put it on the foot of an NFL kicker. And I mean, we see it in college football too, where these guys just pack it away, salt the clock, don't go for a touchdown, kicker shanks one, and everyone, you know, blames the kicker and wonders how that could happen. Play to win the damn game instead of playing not to lose the game.
Well, I mean, honestly, the Bills, I'd rather they get rolled the way they got rolled, but that game, one play, the whole game decided. It's before the half, they're up 7-3, Eagles can't get a first down. And the Bills have a chance to go down the field, get a field goal, and go up 10-3 at the half. 3rd and 2 from your own 20. And they call a designed running play for Josh Allen. Well, yeah, I get it. Josh Allen can run. His dangers when he scrambles and, you know, but to call a designed running play on 3rd and 2, and, you know, linebacker hits him, he fumbles the football. They gift wrap them 8 points. Eagles get the ball out of the half, go down the field and score. And then the Bills were deflated, and the first time their defense let up some big plays. But one play, the whole game was decided. And you're like, of all the things you could call, that's the call you had? give it to Gore, give it Singletary. Why are you making your quarterback? I mean, the quarterback running a sweep. It's one thing when he's scrambling and lays down and gives up himself, but when you're exposing him to linebackers, you're asking for trouble. It's dumb.
Yeah, and the Buccaneers, too. I mean, they got a 4th-and-1. They're kind of driving down the field. They're trying to put themselves in a position to win the game. And I get it. Jameis Winston's a turnover machine. And I understand maybe not having a whole lot of trust in him. But you hand it off to Peyton Barber on 4th-and-1.
Oh,
Jameis Winston
hideous.
He's supposed to be your franchise player, right? I mean, that if the ball can't be in his hands on 4th-and-1, trailing by 4, you need a touchdown. You don't just need to get in a field goal range. You need 6 points, and Jameis can't have the ball in his hands. Well, he's not your guy then. And maybe that's a sign of that, but man, I don't get it. I don't get why the Bears are still in love with Mitch Trubisky when Chase Daniel has a better chance of moving that team up and down the field. And they even moved the ball with Trubisky, but then completely stalled in the red zone. I'll tell you what, man, I don't mind if I lose on a bad handicap, like getting my brain caved in with Carolina and San Francisco.
It's
I'm
easier
okay with that.
Yeah. It's easier
it's
to
so
take
much
that.
Easier. But yeah. There are so many instances where, Chicago, right side, complete right side. Matt Nagy is just a dumbass and an imbecile. Tampa Bay was probably the right side. God damn it, it's frustrating.
Tampa Bay was the right side. In the Chicago thing, it's easy to say, an NFL kicker, you missed whatever it was, a 39-yarder. But literally, they had the defense running for their lives, and they were gassed and out of breath. Run a few more plays and get it a little closer. Wouldn't be the end of the world. I mean, the wind happens to swirl there. Hello? make it and you're already, a franchise that's scarred by missed kicks at the end of the game. Make it as easy as you can. You shake your head, man.
And not only, Chicago attempted 5 field goals from 22 yards or closer. For God's sake, get in the damn end zone. Call better plays in the red. I get it. Mitch Trubisky's not very good. But if you're Matt Nagy and you're supposed to be this brilliant offensive mind, which is why Chicago hired you, because they already had the really good defense, and you can't get into the end zone, well, why are you calling play? Why are you an NFL head coach?
Hey, bud, listen, the Cleveland game, the Patriots were barely there. That game was there for the taking, and Chubb fumbles the kickoff for Turner. It's a completely different game to the point where not only does Cleveland cover, probably have a chance to win the game. And this kid's running, and he's looking at the big screen, and you can tell he's running, and he's looking at the big screen, and you're tired, and it's the tail end of a kickoff. Like, if anybody's coming at you, they're coming for the ball. You shake your head. You just go, what? By the way, Patriots will be interesting to watch here in the next little bit. They've got a gauntlet coming up. And I don't know that this is the week. They're playing Baltimore. And Baltimore's playing terrific football. But I can almost – it's funny. I can see the Patriots in, oh, okay, everybody says we don't play anybody. We'll show them. I can kind of see that this week. But the gauntlet coming up, Ravens, Eagles on the road, Cowboys at home, at Houston, in Kansas City. The Patriots are winning the division. The Patriots are going to be there at the end of the year. I do think this is a team. The defense is spectacular. I do think the offense is limited. They cannot run the football. And it's they're introducing each other into the huddle in terms of wide receivers. So, they haven't played anybody, really. So let's see what comes up with them the rest of the way. But the one thing, they're on the fast track to play 2 games at home and go again.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, this week's interesting with Baltimore off the bye. But, yeah, I agree that this may be the spot where New England says, hey, everyone's talking all this stuff about us. Well, they go out there and beat Baltimore and then possibly lose to Philadelphia. I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me at all. But, I didn't even scratch the surface of complaining about Bill O'Brien, who keeps running the ball on first down against an Oakland pass defense that can't stop anybody. So,
well, his play calling for a couple of years has been a train wreck.
Yeah, Deshaun Watson's like a top 3 quarterback in the NFL, and for the numbers he puts up, it still feels like he's being wasted by Bill O'Brien, which is just unbelievable.
Well, how about that AFC South, though? We did talk about that in the summer months. Throw a blanket over them. I think all 4 of them are flawed, but I think all 4 of them are good, and I think Tennessee with Tannehill now, is, you know, a danger as well. I mean, Tannehill's not going to set the world on fire, but Mariota couldn't get out of his own way. But those four teams, those are back alley fights.
And we will talk about the Texans and Jaguars here in a minute, but I do want to get some thoughts here earlier on in the week on Bang the Book Radio about this Thursday night game, San Francisco and Arizona. 49ers up to a 10-point favorite just about market-wide, at least in terms of the offshore numbers. Couple of stray 9.5s still out there on this one, but man, I'll tell you what, there were a lot of people saying the same thing about San Francisco that they were saying about New England. Oh, they haven't played anybody. You know, they've been catching some pretty decent teams in some bad spots. They caught a Carolina team that was in a great spot. Yeah, it was cross-country travel, but off a bye, healthy Christian McCaffrey, and they just took him to the woodshed.
They're getting better, Adam. If anything, they're getting better. They had the bye so early. They didn't want to bye. But there's a team. They're fast on both sides of the ball. The funny thing is, I think, you know, when the day comes when something goes awry, I think Garoppolo's kind of the question mark there. Sometimes his decision-making is a little suspect. But, boy, they're just getting better with each passing week. Short week, you're going on the road. I would say this, the travel, when things even out, when you say, oh, short week and you got to go on the road, I think San Francisco was sitting at home after the game. They just went out, went out, had a couple of cocktails Monday. They're in the ice tub. Arizona coming home from New Orleans at the end of the day may be worse than what San Francisco's got to go through to get there for the game Thursday. So I'd say throw that out. But I'd probably lean to the over in the game. I think Kenyon Drake's going to be the running back for Arizona. I mean, I don't know who wants to be a running back for Arizona, because if you are, you get hurt. But they bring Kenyon Drake in. Murray makes plays running around with his feet, so he buys time and he can make the occasional big play. Still a kid, and we know the San Francisco defense is ball hawking. I like the total over more than I do the side, because I think it's a touch out of control.
Yeah, I agree with you about San Francisco getting better. And I mean, Kyle Shanahan's brilliant. I've talked about that so many times over here on this show. And what Robert Saleh is doing with that defense, very, very impressive as well. I want to take Arizona here, but I don't think I can do it, because you've got first-year head coach in Cliff Kingsbury that, I mean, he was never great in college. I mean, everyone looks at him as an offensive genius, and maybe he is, and maybe some of these schemes will work in the NFL. But you got the first-year head coach. You got the first-year starting quarterback. Yeah, I think San Francisco is maybe in a spot where we can sell a little bit high. I just don't think that this spot necessarily sets up all that well to do it. And then, of course, the following week, they're on extra rest and extra prep. So maybe the following week's not a great time to go against San Francisco. But, at some point, somebody will have to trip this team up. It's not going to be on Halloween, I don't think.
Well, you kind of made my case for me, at least for me. When you say, with conviction, you say, I want to do something, but I can't. that means the numbers were kind of where it should be, and stay away from it. I do think you'll see points in this game. The Niners just keep bringing fresh running backs at you. Debo Samuel was invisible for a month, but now he's reappeared. But it's this defense every week. I mean, Adam, the turnovers they create in short fields, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it really is. And it's kind of interesting here as you look at the way things set up for San Francisco. They've got that game against the Cardinals this week. Then they get the Seahawks on November 11th. So they'll be plenty rested and ready to go for that one. And of course, when we look at a team like Seattle, a lot of question marks with that team. We'll see how they do here with the Buccaneers. But a lot of people view them as an overachieving 6-2 team. Of course, they let Atlanta back in the game last week, but that was a 24-0 game at halftime, so don't worry too much about that one. I think that's a really interesting game there in the NFC West as we take a little bit of a look ahead to Week 10.
Real quick, what I would just say, and we'll see if it gets to that point, but the monster game is December 8th, and that's San Francisco at New Orleans, and the way things are going, and we'll see what happens with the Packers. But, I mean, that is a game that could go a long way towards deciding who's hosting the NFC Championship game. But the Niners, as you said, Seattle at home in Arizona, and Green Bay, three-game homestand, then back-to-back at Baltimore and at New Orleans. So they got a salty schedule coming up. But that game down the road, it's kind of like you're pointing to, been saying for 4 weeks, can Penn State get through this gauntlet? And they beat Iowa and they beat Michigan, and they beat Michigan State, who had extra rest. And, you know, okay, they got through the gauntlet. Watch them stub their toe against Minnesota. But you're pointing weeks ahead to say, can Penn State make it to the Ohio State on game unbeaten? And got the same thing here with the Niners. Can they make it to December 8th for that game with New Orleans? But that could end up being one of the games of the year.
Yeah, it definitely could. And I don't know if this will be one of the games of the year, but it should be a pretty good one here. As you know what? I'm just going to go ahead and say it. The Jacksonville Jaguars are at home in London at Wembley Stadium.
Yeah, there you go.
Against the Houston Texans. This is the seventh time that Jacksonville will play over in London. They did lose last year to the Eagles 24-18. They also had that huge win in 2017, 44-7. Jacksonville is 3-3 straight up in their games across the pond. Houston, on the other hand, they've only been there once. They lost back in 2016. They actually lost in Mexico in 2016. They've never actually been over in London. So, you know, we'll see what kind of equalizer that is here in this one. Houston down to a 1.5-point favorite, and I feel like the situational elements are kind of driving the early movement here.
Yeah, and I would just say this, and it's not that this black and white, but sometimes keep it simple, stupid. They played in week two. Houston won the game 13-12. And I think when this AFC South, they know each other. I think all the defenses are pretty solid. J.J. Watt nicked up, but I would say the starting point for me is under 47.
Yeah, I think that's a good starting point. And, you know, I kind of looked at this game and I sort of thought about this yesterday that, you know, with how Houston is playing and with how Jacksonville has been kind of, you know, uneven. They've been good. They've been bad. They've been good. They've been bad. Gardner Minshew's looked really good. Gardner Minshew has looked like, you know, a rookie quarterback that, you know, really only had the 1 year starting in FBS. They've been kind of all over the place. But I did feel like there was some home field advantage baked into this line for Jacksonville to begin with the number only coming out 2.5. Now that it's down to 1.5, it does look like Jacksonville is the sharper of the sides here. And yeah, J.J. Watt out for the year doesn't help Houston, but you know, with what Deshaun Watson's been able to do, you would think Houston would get a little bit more respect, but maybe this winds up being, you know, a game where Sharp and Public goes the same way because of Jacksonville's experience there playing in London and in particular at Wembley Stadium.
Well, I don't know that you can just draw this parallel, but I mean, sometimes you look at something and it looks foreign to the eye. And you say, oh, the number's telling me something. I mean, this number, to me, it kind of resembles, you know, Philly at Buffalo last week. You know, that number was telling you the Eagles was the side. You know, the Bills off to a great start. Eagles get pumped by Dallas. They're going on the road. That number was telling you that the sharp money was on the Eagles.
Yeah, and I talked about that on yesterday's show, and I talked about it last week on the show, and I still didn't pull the trigger on Philadelphia, and that's one that upsets me, because like you said, everything about that game, all the context clues in that line were telling you exactly who to take, and it kind of wound up playing out that way. As you said, the game was hanging in the balance right before halftime, but you know, Philadelphia did put that one away in the second half. So,
well, then I would say, and as a result, you'd say the Bills didn't play well 2 weeks. You say they played down to the level of competition with the Dolphins, although we saw the Dolphins with Fitzpatrick, I mean, are at least moderately competitive. Now the Bills feel like they haven't played well 2 weeks in a row. Now the number comes down against Washington. They're laying, and the sharp money's coming on Washington. That's down to 9.5. I would like to think that McDermott gets in these guys' ears and go, all right, fellas, let's go. Let's get our act together here. And, you know, to me, I would think if you're going to, you know, regroup and get that bounce in your step, this looks like a game to me. Buffalo should bounce back and it should be Woodshed City against Washington, but the number's deflated because of what we just last watched.
Yeah, and something else that's interesting about that game is, I mean, I haven't seen any update about Case Keenum. Is Case Keenum going to play? I didn't say anything about it.
If it's Haskins and the Bills don't win by 21, there should be an investigation.
Yeah, I'm surprised to see this number up and surprised to see it even kind of moving on Washington with the uncertainty of where Case Keenum is right now. I mean, again, concussions are a very finicky thing. I know he had the extra time coming off the Thursday night game, but I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen any kind of update here as of yet as to the status of Case Keenum. So I'm surprised not just that the line is up, but that the line is moving down on Washington. Again, would suggest that maybe somebody knows something about Washington and that Keenum's probably going to play. But again, a developing situation that we'll have to watch here throughout the course of the week. Brian, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, as somebody from Buffalo, you ought to be used to the cold, but there's nothing cold about the Buffalo Sabres right now. Did lose last night to Arizona, but 9-2-2 to start the year, 20 points, the most in the NHL. And, you know, hey, it's really just like we all thought with Buffalo, Colorado, and Edmonton being some of the best teams in the NHL so far.
Well, Colorado's not a shock. Edmonton and Buffalo are. Yeah, that game was sickening last night. Sabres were up 2-0. Hutt made a bunch of 10-bell saves, and then he let two garbage goals in, and they lost in a shootout. But, I mean, the difference is when you stub your toe and you're getting a point, which is to me is always – I hate when they – oh, well, at least they got a point. But, you know, when you're a team like Buffalo that hasn't been in the playoffs forever today, if you're losing but you're still getting a point, it makes a difference. But Eichel's on a mission. He's playing unbelievably, and they've got some depth, and their defense is a lot better. So, and I do envision a trade coming here shortly. They just got an injury to Scandella, who is the guy rumored to maybe be getting moved. But they've got Brandon Montour, who's finally back practicing, who, you know, in their heart of hearts believe he could be their number one defenseman, and he hasn't even played to start the season. So they're getting they got a logjam on defense. I think in the not too distant future, I think they make a move. Shipping out a quality defenseman to maybe get a little more scoring. But no, it's fun, bud. I mean, believe me, I went through this last year. They were number one overall in the league at Thanksgiving and drove off a cliff. So that's always out there. You're like, well, but I think this Coach Kruger has them focused where bad things happen to them and they don't panic. And I think mentally they're a lot stronger team too.
Here's something I want to ask you about. This is something I kind of thought a little bit more about last year in both the NHL and the NBA. The streakiness of teams, because I'm a baseball guy. I'm a sabermetrics guy. I'm big on sample size. I need a big body of work to make a lot of determinations. And, you know, it seems like maybe to some degree that just doesn't work as well in the NBA and the NHL, where you've got teams that'll win 3 in a row, lose 3 in a row, win 4 in a row, or win 7 out of 10. Then kind of fall back a little bit. And as you look at the NHL here right now, we've got the Islanders that have won 7 in a row. Once again, Barry Trotz doing an incredible job there.
Amazing coach.
That have lost 8 in a row. And nobody else in the league has won or lost 3 or more games in a row. So do you kind of read into that and look for some of those short-term streaks?
Oh, sure. I mean, I'd be watching the Sabres closely. Their big mantra was, you know, every team wants to do this. But they bounce back every time they've had a loss. They don't want to suffer back-to-back defeats. So, you know, we'll see how this all plays out. And if they got a tiger by the tail in their next game when the Caps come to Buffalo. But that'll be intriguing. But absolutely streaks. But I would say more than that are scheduling things and historical things that repeat themselves over the course of every year. And I would just say this to you, and I'll give you Vegas as a perfect example. I think there have been real problems, and the quick answer from everybody around here is, oh, well, Nate Schmidt's out. Okay, great. Yeah, I get it. Nate Schmidt's a terrific player. He's not Bobby Orr. Nate Schmidt's out. That doesn't mean five other guys are playing horribly in their own end because Nate Schmidt's out. Alex Tuch is coming back. So, yeah, things should get better for them, but I'm watching teams that just look faster than them. So now I want to see in the short term, they got absolutely steamed. But all the betting angles we talk about, Adam, you talk about a gray area where what do you do with these guys? Vegas goes on a 3-game road trip. They got killed by the Flyers. They pulled the goalie. We're lucky to beat Chicago, getting out of Dodge. So now the first game home from an Eastern road trip, they come home. We always say that's a tough game to play. They get murdered on Friday afternoon by Colorado. So Colorado goes home. back-to-back nights. They go home. Anaheim sitting there waiting for them. Anaheim beats Colorado. Now, Anaheim beats Colorado, playing in altitude, has to fly to Vegas. They just beat Colorado, who just murdered Vegas, and Anaheim comes to Vegas, has nothing in the tank. Vegas murders Colorado. Vegas' next two games, they've got, so everybody's like, oh, Vegas is back. Well, wait a minute. They played a team that just played at altitude in the night before. You know, I mean, you got to take it with a grain of salt. Vegas' next game, they get Montreal in here. Montreal's playing the night before coming in here. The game after that, they play Winnipeg. Winnipeg is playing at San Jose the night before. So the next two games, or this three-game run, things are set up on a plate for Vegas, but that doesn't mean they fixed all their problems. You know, talk to me in 10 days, 2 weeks, when they got to play some back-to-back games or they're playing teams that are fresh. So that's the thing. You got to break down the schedule more than anything when you're handicapping hockey games.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I can throw out a shameless plug here for the article I do every week at bangthebook.com. Looking at those situational spots in the NHL does get posted on Sunday night for you to check out. And I completely agree with you. You know, there are a lot of spots and a lot of people will overreact to some of these performances, not realizing that, you know, these teams are just in really, really good spots from time to time. What about tonight on the card, Brian? Anything you're seeing that kind of jumps out at you here for this evening?
Oh, the Tuesday night card. San Jose's a dog's breakfast right now. I mean, just a disaster. That was one of the best bets we were going to have in our lifetime, Adam, was last week, the game at Montreal, when San Jose and their captain, Couture, called out a couple of guys by name, said they were selfish, had no business being on the team. Then they had to go and play Montreal. It's like their season was on the line. You know, the captain had to play big. The guys that got called out had to play big. Sure enough, they went up there as a dog and won. They've since lost two in a row. It was a tipping point that there's something really wrong, and this is a dysfunctional group. In that one instance, they put a Band-Aid on a head wound, and tonight they're playing Boston. San Jose's brutal on their own end. I think you could see over the total. The San Jose Boston. Boston's playing at a ridiculous level right now. Toronto's under a lot of pressure. It's early in the season. I mean, these people are just, you know, they're down to the quick with their fingernails. I mean, they're going nuts up there.
Yeah, and I look at that San Jose and Boston game, and it's the fifth road game in 8 days for San Jose, so it's not a really good spot for them either as they are finishing up a road trip. What about that? What about the last game of a road trip? Is that one where you typically look to fade a team?
In many instances, yeah. I mean, they're like, I want to get home. You know, I just got to get out of there. Halfway through the game, their head's already on the plane. You know, they're pictured, you know, putting their feet back on the plane, having a beer, going home, and just get the hell out of Dodge. And then the first game home's a brutal one, especially after a long trip. This is a team that's in big trouble right now. But the one thing is, you get Carlson and Burns, and these guys can generate offense. But there's so much about generating offense, the odd man rushes and stuff they allow in their own end of the rink. It's ridiculous. They're completely out of sorts. You know, and everybody, you know, blame Martin Jones or Dell. It's not the goalie's fault. The quality of the shots these guys are facing. I mean, I think six is a bargoon, to be honest with you. I think the way the Sharks are going, you know, I think you could be looking at 6.5 totals there. Last game did go over the total. The previous two went under, but the Montreal game, that was the game they had to show up, and the Leafs game, they ran for the bus. They allowed four goals in the third period. So the way things are trending in the last four periods, they've allowed nine goals. So I'll look over the total.
One other team I want to take a quick look at here in the NHL, then we'll spend a few minutes on the golf event here in China this week. The Dallas Stars. I mean, they were, what, the fifth favorite, or the fifth highest team to win the Stanley Cup here, and they've gotten off to a very sluggish start, only laying about $1.45, $1.50 tonight against a Minnesota team that's had its fair share of problems. Have we reached a buy low point on Dallas?
Well, the one thing, I'm trying to add it up here real quick. 1, 2, 3, 4. They are 8-1 to the under in their last nine. All right. And Don Cherry brought up a great point on Hockey Night in Canada. I said all summer long, and got laughed at all summer long, that I thought the St. Louis Blues could have a real hard time this year And I to the point where I said, I think the Blues may be hard pressed to even make the playoffs. And the Stanley Cup hangover is a real thing. But now the Blues are 6-3-3. They are Jekyll and Hyde. They came out of the gate early, then they hit the skids, then they put it back together. Now Tarasenko's hurt and he's out 5 months. You're asking me about Dallas. It's the same thing, and this is the point Don Cherry made, that the Blues, and as it turns out, the Stars too, who had success in the playoffs, are playing the style of hockey that was successful for them in the playoffs. You can't do that in the regular season. Anybody that doesn't believe that hockey changes and there's different segments of a season are fools. This is pond hockey at the moment. You get to January, things will tighten up a little bit. Then you get to the trade deadline. Now you're built with the team that you're going to go to war with, and then the coaches start implementing a playoff style they want to play. And the games start to be lower scoring in the back third of the season. But so now St. Louis and Dallas, they're trying to exact a physical toll on teams in playing like a physical brand of hockey that they played in the playoffs. Well, that works, Adam, in a series when you maybe lose game one, but you beat the hell out of a team and you turn around and play them in game two. And that's how the Blues won the Cup. They wore teams down in every series. But when pick a team, I don't know, when Carolina comes in and you try to beat the hell out of them, well, you may beat the hell out of them, but Carolina won the game. You know what I mean? And you don't get to reap the rewards of then they're beat up and you're going to beat them in the next game because you don't see them again. So maybe you fade the teams that play St. Louis and Dallas after they play them. But right now, you can't hit what you can't catch. It's pond hockey. So St. Louis and Dallas, in Dallas, obviously, they've got the great goaltender, but they can't shoot it in the ocean. So it's a stylistic thing for those two teams.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, Dallas struggled to score at the outset of last season, too. So, you know, I mean, that wasn't necessarily coming off of the playoff hangover or anything, but just a team that maybe it takes them a little bit of time to get going. I guess we'll kind of wait and see, and we'll see what they're able to do here tonight.
Well, don't forget last year, they were driving off a cliff. And I don't even remember who the hell the guy was. It was a team vice president or whoever the hell it was called Ben out. He called them out. Remember that?
And then,
he challenged them and basically was calling them lazy dogs. And, you know, it was like the movie Major League where they got the owner and they're tearing strips off the owner after every win. They were playing against that guy. It worked. But, you know, again, you know, is that putting a Band-Aid on a head wound?
I guess we'll find out. And I guess we'll find out here about the WGC HSBC Champions event over in China. And look, you got to be pretty good to win this thing with the list of names that has won this. Xander Schauffele last year, Justin Rose 2 years ago, Matsuyama 3 years ago. Russell Knox kind of stands out, but that's a guy that for some reason he winds up playing pretty well in some big events. Bubba Watson, Dustin Johnson, Ian Poulter, Martin Keimer, Francesco Molinari, Mickelson's won this twice, Garcia's won it, so pretty good field and usually a pretty good winner here for this one over at Shoshone Golf Club. Rory McIlroy is your favorite in the plus 550 range. Matsuyama, who finished second to Tiger last week at 12-1, Schauffele 14, Rose 16, Casey Fleetwood, Finau, Stenson, some of the other names here in this thing. This isn't as top heavy as you would expect it to be this time around though, Brian.
I'm keeping this simple, Adam. I won't go bananas. I got a three-pack for you, and that is Xander Schauffele, the defending champion, at 14-1. Played very well in Japan. Tiger's story, but you know, we don't have to waste a lot of time, and that was remarkable. He turned the clock back 15 years, and he was just a rabbit. He's the greatest rabbit in the history of sports. Once he gets the lead, he ain't coming back to you. But I thought Schauffele played well enough on the weekend, so he's in good form. Coming to a place where he got his biggest win to date. So Schauffele at 14-1 is, you know, a little low, but of the favorites, I'd look with him. I think the sharp money's telling you something here, and this has got to be sharp money. Shane Lowry, I want to throw a parade for the guy still. I had him. He was my top pick in the British Open, and he won at 80-1. He had a good weekend in Japan. He had a great final round. He's coming in good form. You know, he probably spent 2 months drinking out of the claret jug, and a lot of guys disappear after winning majors. I think Lowry's on the bounce back. That final round says something to me. And the one that I think's a sneaky good price play. Did you watch the golf at all over the weekend? Were you watching Tiger?
I caught Tiger's last few holes. That was it.
Okay. I watched all day Saturday. It's Friday, Saturday, but it was basically Saturday, Sunday over in Japan. But they played 29 holes on Saturday because of the rain. The second round was washed out. They never repaired. So the final group was Tiger, Gary Woodland, and Keegan Bradley. And Bradley kind of just floated around on the early stages of Saturday. But he actually played really well at the end. But Keegan Bradley was there and played the final 20-odd holes with Tiger Woods and played well. And I think, you know, he's surrounded by that. He was on the big stage. He fell back, but then he kind of put it back together and he played well. But he was under the spotlight in that final group. I think Keegan Bradley is a real strong, solid, under-the-radar play at 70-1 this week.
Yeah, and I'm even seeing 90 out there in some of the offshore markets. So a lot of different good looks here for this tournament. Again, a good field, not a great field. Missing guys like Johnson, like Day, like some of the other big names that are out there. But still a pretty solid field here for this. I believe it's the final event of the Asian Swing, correct?
I don't know. It's got to be winding down, I would think. Well, the President's Cup's right around the bend, right? That's got to be coming up any day.
Yeah. Yeah, I forgot about the President's Cup being the President's Cup. The timing of that is weird. To start the wraparound portion of the season and then go to the President's Cup, strange.
The President's Cup, it's a nothing burger to me. The good thing is, though, I do believe, you can. It's like anything. You watch them come out of the gate and you see who's in good form. I think there's good opportunities from a matchup perspective for the President's Cup, but it is. It's kind of the stepchild to the Ryder Cup. I mean, it's from a betting perspective, you play matchups, but I don't know. I'm not losing too much sleep over who's playing and who isn't until it gets there.
December 15th for the President's Cup, week off next week, and then the Mayakoba Golf Classic in Mexico on November 17th, where I'm sure we'll mention Pat Perez, an older guy that plays very well in some of those warmer destinations.
And we won't get into it, but there's the Bermuda Championship. So you get another event you brought up. It's a Stableford. They throw one guy out there, 60-1, I take a shot with. When you look at the quality of the field that's there, Scott Stallings at 60-1, I think, is a ridiculous price. So the guys that are playing down there, I trust Scott Stallings a lot more than a lot of the guys are playing in that tournament. But, again, it's the quirky thing. It's the Stableford thing where you get points.
This is a stroke play event. I was mistaken the Barracuda Championship with the Bermuda Championship because...
Well, I like Stallings even more than...
Close enough. Well, there you go.
I like him even more. No, I mean, I'm just looking at the guys that are in the field, and this is a guy that can contend in main events, and I think, if he gets into contention on the weekend and he's staring down some of these other guys, Scott Stallings, I can see kick a door down.
That obviously goes without saying, but, it's an island area, so you may have wind. So keep in mind, you probably want to find some good wind players out there for the Bermuda Championship as well. Brian Blessing, the host of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. How can people find those two shows, Brian?
Well, Adam, it's a crazy week. In fact, as soon as we get off the hopper here, I get back to work. I'm working on the Breeders' Cup, which is coming up this weekend. Really excited about that. We'll be doing a Breeders' Cup seminar Friday night, 6 p.m. Sunset Station. If anybody's coming to town, and you're looking, we've had really good success dishing out some long shots. Richie Ng, Hank Goldberg, Dave Leno, the track fan, and myself, Chuck Esposito, 6 p.m. Sunset Station if you're in town. And the radio shows, noon to 2 weekdays, Sportsbook Radio, the top sportsbook directors and handicappers. That's noon to 1, 1 to 2 p.m., Vegas Hockey Hotline. Great hockey guests. We had Eddie Olczyk on last week, did a little Breeders' Cup chat with him and hockey. If you're a hockey fan, think you really like the hockey show, that's 1 to 2 p.m. You can catch the shows at kshp.com. There's the listen live function there, and the shows are archived at sportsbookradio.com. We do videos for our friends at Bang the Book. You can follow me on Twitter, Brian Blessing. I probably left something out, but that's enough.
No, yeah, we should do. I'm sure you'll have a Breeders' Cup video this week. And if we can, we'll try and do a quick Breeders' Cup segment on Friday morning here this week for our listeners out there. So hopefully we can get a chance to do that. If not, you can check out my preview over at bangthebook.com. I'll have one of those this week. And of course, check out Brian's video as well at Brian Blessing on Twitter. As he said, Brian, appreciate the time, man. Thank you so much.
All right.
For joining
me. We'll try to do the thing Friday, but right now I'll just say in the turf, I'm building my whole day around a couple of horses and pick threes and pick fours in the turf. Two trainers that have a history of winning this event, Aiden O'Brien, and Charles Appleby. Anthony Van Dyck is Aiden O'Brien's horse, and the one to watch out for is Old Persian, and that's in the Breeders' Cup turf. But we'll try to do something on Friday. But love the Breeders' Cup. I'm sorry, but I know you got to get the Ralph here. The one thing I will tell you, when you're trying to find value, that's why I love this weekend. The best jockeys and the best horses in the world are at Santa Anita. You know what that means? That means there are all kinds of opportunities at all the other tracks because the best jockeys in the jockey colony have hit the road, and you can sit there and find value at all the other tracks because the best jockeys aren't there. I love this weekend.
All right. Sounds good. Like we said, we'll try to talk about that here on Friday. Once again, with Brian Blessing at Brian Blessing on Twitter. Brian, appreciate your time, brother. Thank you so much, man. We'll talk to you again later on in the week.
All right, pal. Adam, have a good day.
There you go. There's Brian Blessing, the host of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline, KSHP.com, and at Brian Blessing on Twitter. All right, we got one more guest, one more segment here for this Tuesday edition of Bang the Book Radio. That is professional handicapper Ralph Michaels from WagerTalk.com. Ralph, how's it going today, man?
Going great. You know, a week away from college football, can't be more excited.
Yeah,
a week away. How about college basketball, I should say? You know, there's always college football a week away, but a week away from college basketball is what I'm really excited about.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's nice to get a new season. It's nice to have an opportunity to maybe get into a market that's not as efficient as college football is right now.
Agree. You know, 353 teams, the Vegas bookmakers, you know, are going to do their diligence. But again, it's difficult to post numbers on those. And unlike college football, where lines have been out since the summer and you could find a multitude of power ratings, you know, they're not out there in college basketball. With 353 teams, there's very few people that have had numbers on all those teams. And again, college basketball, that's why you find value early. You have multiple games in a week, 353 teams, a lot of weird matchups with the tournaments and the non-conference schedules. So it really is. Just being in a position to cherry pick the best of the best where there's a discrepancy in the lines.
Well, and of course, you've been hard at work on college basketball. College basketball really is your sport. You excel at it. You do a very, very good job of it. What have you been looking at here of late in terms of getting ready for the season here, which, as you mentioned, next Tuesday already?
Yeah, next Tuesday with 146 games, I believe. So, you know, talking about some of the new rule changes, there's only two new rule changes this year. The first, I don't think there's going to be much of a difference in the way the game is played, and that is that the shot clock gets reset to 20 seconds after an offensive rebound. So the only time that comes into effect is late in the game, and, you know, most of the time that's in foul situations. So I do like that rule. The second is I think, significant. You know, the three-point line getting moved back from 20 feet 9 inches to 22 feet 1 and 3 quarters inches, and that's a 6.7% difference. And, you know, the percent may not seem huge at 7%, but, you know, these kids have grown up the last few years playing an offense in the system they're comfortable with, being in the spots on the court that they like to shoot. So I think there will be a significant change. You know, in the NIT, it was too small of a sample size in last year's NIT tournament when they tested it. But you have some teams, and I went back and pulled off the teams that have shot the most three-pointers. Savannah State shot 39 three-pointers per game. Citadel, 34.5. Winthrop, 32. And then Auburn and Villanova shot 33 pointers per game. So those are the five teams that you automatically look at. And then you have Buffalo, Elon, Marshall, Youngstown State, Akron and Presbyterian, Fresno State. Those teams all shot 28 or more. So you're talking a significant amount of the offense. When you look at percentage-wise, Lehigh led the country at 42% from three-pointers. Wofford was 41. South Dakota State was 41. Obviously, we know, Wofford and South Dakota State both lost stars, so those percentages are going to go down. So you have to look if a team is going to lose a percent or two on their shooting, if they're going to try a few less three-pointers, we're going to see how much that affects the teams that shoot a lot and then how much it affects the total. So you can guesstimate what you think is going to happen early, but, you know, until we see it play out 3-4 weeks into it, you know, then we'll have to see if we could beat the adjustments that Vegas is going to need to make and if the public's even going to be aware of those adjustments early by checking, you know, the scoring after multiple days or multiple weeks.
Well, and as I look at Bart Torvik here from last year, looking at the share of threes coming from those offensive possessions, some big name teams out there. Villanova was third in the country. They took a ton of three-pointers last year. Auburn took a lot. A team like North Dakota State out of the Summit League. Siena, Fresno State, Furman, Creighton. A lot of teams out there. Utah took a lot of threes. Davidson, of course, as we know, a jump shooting team. So you got a lot of teams here that are going to be affected by this, and some of the bad defense is probably going to get a little bit better, as you mentioned. But also, one of the other elements I saw, and I was kind of reading up on this morning, is that one of the reasons that they decided to make this rule is that it would make the lane a little bit more accessible for some of those guards that like to get to the rack. So some of the teams that have bad perimeter defenses, we may think that this will help them because of their three-point shooting defense, but also if their guards just don't defend well, the opposition is going to get a lot of clean looks at the rim too. So, you know, again, a lot of schematic things come into play with a rule change like this.
It does. And, you know, what I think is that, you know, the more athletic guys are clearly going to have an advantage. You know, you see a team, last year, you know, I believe Houston led the country in three-point defense. It was Houston, VCU, Murray State, Virginia, Oregon, Michigan. Well, you know, right there, that shows you those are all damn good teams. So if you're going to look at a stat, I mean, that's a stat that you have to look at to show what good teams are. Well, why are those good teams good? Well, number one, they play interior defense. And number two, they have athletic guards to be able to get out and guard the three-pointers. So, you know, I think we're going to see a little bit of a separation where, you know, this helps the more athletic teams because they can get out and cover the deeper three-pointers. Where the guys that pack in the zone, now we'll have to see. Do they extend the zone? Does that leave the back door cuts wide open? So, you know, you look at it and you say, well, it's only, you know, a foot and couple inches. But, you know, you spread that field, you spread that quarter an extra 7%. And schematically, it's going to change a lot.
Yeah, for sure. You think about teams like Virginia Tech, Syracuse, a team like Georgia State that made out of the Sun Belt, you know, they tended to play very good interior defense. Oregon, same thing. So like you said, you know, having to stretch that zone out a little bit, does that open some more of the mid-range game for some of these teams, a little more pick and roll? It's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out. And I'm also curious to see how it will play out, you know, not just from an X's and O's standpoint, but from the standpoint of how totals are listed. You know, these teams that are very reliant on the long distance jump shots, will we see their totals maybe held down a point or two, 3 points, something like that, until we start to see some data on this? Similarly, those teams that, you know, maybe aren't very good on offense, take a lot of threes, you know, what happens with their totals? I think that's going to be really intriguing to find out.
Yeah, you know, looking on the Wager Talk college basketball cheat sheet I'm looking at, there were 24 teams that averaged over 38% last year. And, you know, we've seen the carryover in the NBA, and that's why, you know, you have some of these upsets you do. Well, you know, if you could shoot 40% from the three-point line, that's like shooting 60% from mid-range, you know, two-point shots. And to me, you know, I think we're going to see a drop in scoring. If I can make a guess, you know, I'm gonna say that 6% number that they're moving, the 6% that they're moving back, we're not going to see a 6% difference because, again, it may open up a few more things. But I expect scoring to be down 3 or 4%. So, you know, we'll see if my numbers are right based on the last few years of what the team's averaged and what the adjustments are. The other thing you can't look at is you can't tend to overreact to some early non-conference games. We know that if you're looking at scoring for the entire season, well, when you get into these Big Ten battles, you're not going to have the same high scoring games as you are in some of your non-conference games. So what you need to compare, if you are looking at these early numbers, go back and look to see what the scoring was in November only for the last few years, and then compare it to the November only stats for this year.
Something else I wanted to ask you about here, we talked a lot about returning production when it came to college football, and I presume that's a lot of what people are looking at here in college basketball right now in terms of returning starters, things of that sort, because, look, guard play is just critically important in college basketball. You've got to be able to take care of the basketball. You've got to be able to salt those games away where you have a late lead. So I imagine that's been a pretty important hallmark of your preseason prep. So who are some of the teams that you think, you know, could struggle at the outset because they don't have a lot of experience or returning production against some of those teams that do?
Well, you know, let's just mention there's a handful of teams that return zero starters. And, you know, some are bad teams and some aren't normally line teams. I mean, Chicago State was probably the 50th or 51st team, one of the worst teams in basketball last year playing in the WAC, and they have no returning starters. So you're going to have a new level of ineptness in Chicago State. But the guys that return no starters are Chicago State, Harford, Memphis, Mississippi Valley State, Nebraska, Nevada, Norfolk State, and Tennessee. Now, you know, Memphis, which had the number one recruiting class, is going to be a team like Duke that had no returning starters, and they're still picked as the top 20 team. But outside of Memphis, you know, you're really going to see those teams struggle quite a bit. On the flip side, there's 22 teams that return all five starters, or at least five guys that were a majority of starters in the team. And I'm just going to run them down. And You know, one thing I want to mention to people is five starters doesn't necessitate an automatic play when you see these guys lining up. We've seen in college football this past year, the teams with the most returning starters in college football ended up going, I think, 3-14 against the spread the first 2 weeks. So if you have five guys that started and you were a team that won five games and you were outscored by 18 points per game, those same five starters, they're going to be better, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be an elite team or even an upper level team. So the 22 college teams out of the 353 teams this year that return all five starters, Air Force, Albany, Colorado, Dartmouth and Davidson, East Tennessee State, Eastern Illinois, Lafayette, Long Island, Loyola of Maryland, Manhattan, Mount St. Mary's, North Dakota State, Northern Arizona, Notre Dame, Oklahoma State, Providence, Rhode Island, Richmond, USF, Texas Arlington, and Towson. So just something to keep an eye on. You know, at a glance, I'll have all this on the Wager Talk cheat sheet. You know, I keep adding things, so I keep delaying it, but it will be out by at least Thursday on my page at Wager Talk, which you'll be able to get a quick reference guide for every team and every conference in college basketball.
Well, make sure you follow at CalSportsLV on Twitter as well, where you can find all that information throughout the week from Ralph Michaels. Ralph, let's transition over to college football for a few minutes here, as we've got a lot of games, a lot of interesting games here this week in Week 10. Let's start with BYU and Utah State here. I think this one's interesting because Utah State is playing at a very, very quick tempo, but they are nowhere near as efficient as last season. BYU coming off a little bit of extra rest here. This line's down from 5 to 3.5 very early in the week.
Yeah, I bet it at 5.5, actually, one of the early numbers at the Circa. So I am on BYU. You know, you look at the schedule difference, and BYU has played the number 7 schedule. So when you say, well, they're getting outgained by 25 yards per game, that's really not bad. Utah State's getting outgained by over 10 yards per game against the number 57 schedule. This is where BYU has an edge. That number 7 schedule from the Cougars is because they're an independent. Well, you have trouble scheduling people. So anyone that you're going to play Power 5 opponents, you're going to have to play in their traditional non-conference roles the first 5 weeks. And what did BYU face early? Utah, Tennessee, USC, Washington. A brutal stretch. Now, look what they had. They're off the upset against Boise. They're rested in a bye. They have Utah State, Liberty, Idaho State, UMass, and San Diego State. It's a schedule set up for success. You're sitting at 3-4 with the upset of Boise, the upset of USC, and the upset of Tennessee. You're off a bye. You're playing your in-state rival with double revenge. And on the flip side, you have a Utah State team, which, of course, is in the middle of their conference play. They were off a very difficult game against Air Force where they were embarrassed. 128 yards, 7 first downs last week traveling to Air Force. So their schedule, at LSU, home against Nevada, go to Air Force. You have this BYU game, and then you have to go to Fresno and Wyoming, two very physical teams. So I do like the spot for BYU. They're 10-2. Their last 12 is an away dog, and I think they get the job done with an outright upset.
Yeah, I like that too. I agree with the line move coming down here on this game. In fact, I actually saw this one post offshore. BetOnline had 8 for a very, very short time. Then it went to 6. Then we saw most of the market reopen this one back at 5. So I agree. Great grab by you there on the 5.5. And hopefully that one plays out in your favor. We'll move down a couple of spots here. Game 343, 344 by rotation number is Oregon and USC. Oregon's a 4.5-point road favorite here. But interestingly enough, Pinnacle, the sharpest of the offshore markets, the first one to drop this number down to 4.
Again, Adam, this is my number 2 game that I already played. So it's not as if, though, we spoke. You just happened to pick 2 games that I really did like. And I am on the USC Trojans. You know, you're talking about a team that had to play 3 quarterbacks. And, you know, you're talking about... Matt Fink had to go to BYU his first road start, they lose. Slovis had to go to Washington, first road start, they lose. Then they go to Notre Dame, and what happened? You saw them grow up on the road and learn how to play well. They ended up at Notre Dame only getting outgained by 47 yards. First downs were even. They come home against Arizona where they're playing well, 41-14. The offense starts clicking, 5.6 yards per carry. Again, this may be a run-and-shoot offense, but they do use their running backs. It's not the traditional full Washington State run-and-shoot with Graham Harrell as the OC. The Colorado comeback, again, impressed me. 30 first downs on the road tells me that this offense is doing what you expect. 3 NFL receivers with Pittman, Vaughns, and St. Brown. You know, at home, they're a huge home-road dichotomy for USC. And I look at Oregon. You know, the Oregon put up great numbers early in the year, but we're seeing that those numbers were fairly fake. You know, Auburn with a freshman making his first start in a dome situation, Nevada, no offense, Montana, no offense, Stanford, no offense with no quarterback, Cal, one of the worst offenses in Power 5, Colorado had a lot of guys banged up, Washington, we saw them get exposed, 31 points, 414 yards, Washington State, the exact same offense they're seeing now, 446 yards. They allowed 406 yards passing. That was at home in a setting where they were excited. Now that same defense has to go on the road and play a better passing team with 3 better receivers. And then if you watch that Oregon game, you know, they're off a comeback win against Washington, which impressed the hell out of me. But then what happens in last week's game? They fall behind against Washington State. They come back. They win that game on a late drive. And the players rushed the field like they were an underdog and they won their conference. They were a double-digit favorite at home and you rush the field. That's 2 emotional games in a row against Washington and Washington State. Now having to travel to USC, I believe the Trojans win the game.
Yeah, I like the Trojans to win the game here too. And also that Oregon pass defense. Washington really shredded them, and Washington has not shredded too many teams through the air. Jacob Easton, I don't think he's been what everybody expected there in Seattle. And then, of course, Washington State shreds a lot of teams, but you know they threw for 4 bills on Oregon. So I guess it's set up really, really nicely for USC. I agree with the points. I agree with the outright stance. I think USC is a good-looking play here this week. How about this game? And we jump a couple spots down the board again, 347, 348. it's been a long time since the Sunflower Showdown between Kansas State and Kansas had this much intrigue. But damn, if this isn't one of the best games of the weekend here.
Yeah, isn't it fun? And I'm happy. You know what? I never want to see a team like Kansas be down for as long as they were. You know, I'm not a huge Les Miles fan, but, you know, it's a new attitude there. So I enjoy it. I really don't like, you know, these teams on the bottom. You know, I have two teams that are like 37 in my power ratings with Akron and UMass. That's just crazy low. So, you know, college football is better when we have teams that are at least competitive and not as ugly as they get. You know, in Kansas State, you have a team that is much like a Bill Snyder team. You know, they're going to get outgained in a lot of games. They don't turn the ball over. They run the ball okay. They play very good red zone defense, and they have very good special teams, and that's exactly what you have with K-State. Now, let's remember, you know, you're bringing in a winning mentality. You may think, well, Snyder's gone and Chris Klieman is there. Chris Klieman has won 79% of every game he's coached at North Dakota State. He coached a D3 team and now here. So with him and with his assistants, you have a winning mentality with players buying into the system. And, you know, you look, they got outgained by 100 yards against TCU, won the game. Why? Red zone defense and no turnovers. Oklahoma, you got outgained by 71 yards. What happened? You rushed for 213, you won the rushing battle, and you were plus two turnovers. You know, same thing at Mississippi State. They got outgained by 83 yards per game. So there's times where you look at that and you say, well, hell, their last three wins, Oklahoma, TCU, and Mississippi State, they were outgained by a total of 254 yards, yet they won those. I want to fade that team. But there's just teams that tend to play differently, and I think that's one of them. The thing about Kansas that you have to look at is Les Miles wants to play slow. We know that. He is traditionally one of the slowest paced head coaches, and that's the way they played early. You know, yes, they had 72 plays against Boston College in that upset because they were just playing at a little faster tempo, but that's the same team against West Virginia that only ran 56 plays. Well, you know, when an OC gets fired, when a Washington State DC gets fired because they allowed 100 points to UCLA, you know about it. But Kansas made the change to Brett Dierman at OC the last couple weeks, and he has completely changed this offense. They ran 86 plays at Texas, and they ran over 70 plays against Texas Tech. They are now an up-tempo offense that had 569 and 527 yards the last two games against Texas and Texas Tech. The defense is still giving up a lot of points. They've allowed, you know, they're allowing 474 yards and over 26 first downs per game. So you have a very fast offense on Kansas. You have a very slow offense on Kansas State. Two competing styles, you know, I've gone back and forth in this game. You have K-State excited. They're back in the top 25 and off an upset. And I just tweeted this out, Adam, and I have to jump to Twitter to look what the exact record was. And it surprised me when teams pull the upset as a 20-point dog like Kansas State did against Oklahoma, and they're an away favorite the next week. It's only happened 9 times since 2007, so the last 13 years. But that team is 8-1 straight up, 7-2 against the spread. The last time it occurred was Iowa against Illinois back in 2016. So, you know, you do have the better team. This used to be an automatic for me. Boy, I can tell you, Bill Snyder on Kansas, it didn't matter. He would pound them. He would pound them. He would pound them. He would win and cover. You know, a different dynamic with two new head coaches. I lean with the dog a little bit, but this one, two strong opinions on those first two games, and I'm going to be wishy-washy here and just say I lean with the dog and I lean with the over.
I mean, it's incredible what Kansas is doing offensively this year. They are 33rd in the country in yards per play with 6.33. They were 107th in the country in yards per play last year. So Les Miles doing work. You mentioned that offensive coordinator change having a big impact here. And also, too, I mean, look, 6.4 yards per play in conference games for Kansas. Pretty damn impressive. But Man, from a spot standpoint, this game is such an intriguing handicap, and I agree with you. I think it's very hard to take either side here. Line has moved down from 6.5 to as low as 5, so sharp money on Kansas here early in the week. Maybe you're looking to fade Kansas State off the big win, but also for Kansas here, I don't know how many people saw the way in which they beat Texas Tech last week. It was one of the craziest endings I've ever seen. Field goal gets blocked. Texas Tech tries to recover and return it. They try a lateral. Guy throws the lateral to nobody. Kansas lineman falls on it. They get another crack at the field goal and kick the game winner. And that's a week after they took Texas to the ropes in a 50-48 game. So I think both of these teams are in really challenging spots. Kansas hasn't won this rivalry game since 2009, though. So I guess I favor them. I would take them at the 5.5, but I'm just happy that this game has storylines to talk about, man. It's awesome for Kansas and for these two programs.
It is, and I think the sharp moves, you know, that you talked about is really more because, you know, the Twitter feedback I got when I put out that record was like, holy hell, I would have guessed the exact opposite. But again, you're only talking 8 games in 13 years. So there are going to be so many anomalies in there that it's nothing that you can really say. But, you know, when I looked at teams that just I'm looking right now, if you just said every team that pulled an upset as a 20-point favorite, and it's starting to pull up the numbers, you know, that is still about 50%, where I would have thought it's a negative. But again, college football is a little bit different than the NFL, where, you know, in the NFL with teams with parity, you look at them to return to the median. Back since 2000, boy, it's 50.5%. So teams since 2007, looking back at the last 13 years, teams that are often upset as a 20-plus point dog have gone 50.5% against the spread. So that just tells you one thing. You know, yes, it may affect them. Historically, there's enough times that it's happened where it hasn't been a difference against the spread one way or the other. So while you're adding it to your handicapping, don't over-adjust because of it.
One other college game I actually want to touch on with you here, and we'll just bypass the NFL with you for this week. We'll make up those games on a different segment with somebody else. But game 359-360 here, SMU and Memphis. This line all of a sudden is a runaway train with Memphis up to a 6-point favorite. I thought 3 and 3.5 were a little bit light, but now that this has gone up to 6, I mean, that's some significant money in a very high-profile game.
All right, I am looking now. Do you have a game number, Adam?
359-360.
359-360. My power rating was pick in the game. We weren't planning on talking about it, so sorry, guys, I didn't know that. But so, obviously, you know, I'm leaning the SMU side. Now, I will say this, you know, in last week's game, I almost played against SMU. You are talking about immense pressure. You have a team that, before last week, I thought I would like him at Houston. When Boise State lost to BYU, that all of a sudden made SMU the number one group of five team. So you have every kid on SMU going, if we win this game and this game and this game, we are going to a New Year's Six Bowl, guys. This is amazing. And what happened last week? We saw them struggle. They got outgained by 171 yards off the top of my head at Houston. They did not play well. It was not the same offense. And now you're going to face a Memphis team that's getting ESPN game day. And, you know, while some of the luster has come off ESPN game day and it may not be as exciting and they had to go to an FCS game to draw a fever pitch last week, you're going to Memphis. It's going to be a fever pitch. You know, you're going to get an extra 10,000 people into town to be at that game, to be at that setting. So, you know, I think that adds quite a bit to the home field edge of Memphis. I would probably adjust my number by 1.5 or 2 points because of that. Because, you know, you look at the Liberty Bowl. I don't even know if it's still called the Liberty Bowl. But, you know, how many empty seats do you see? And there's never people in those end sections. And it's always just, you know, a sad setting to watch football. Well, I can tell you now, there's going to be excitement. There's going to be a student section. It's going to be quite different. So, you know, I still look at SMU, and I still think they have the better talent. I'm pulling up my stat compare sheet. I have SMU having played the number 86 schedule, and they're plus 117 yards per game, which is number 25 in the country. Memphis has played the number 97 schedule, so 11 spots weaker, and they're number 30 at plus 95 points per game. But if you look at only that stat, you're going to say, well, SMU has played the tougher schedule, and FSU is better at yards per game. But let's move over to yards per play. SMU is only plus 0.8 yards per play, number 37. Memphis, one of the most impressive stats out there, they're number 12 in the country at plus 2.1 yards per game. Why? SMU is number 2 in the country in plays per game with 83.8. Memphis, a bottom 10, one of the slowest tempo teams at 65.3 plays per game. So you have a 18.4 play per game difference. That's going to skew any stat you have. So who's going to be able to control the tempo? If SMU gets out early and they get the early lead and Memphis has to speed up the tempo, advantage Mustangs. If Memphis can control the tempo, run the ball, do their short passing game, control the clock, slow down the game, that's going to affect SMU not being on the field as much and not being able to play at the pace they're accustomed to.
One more thought to leave everybody with here, and then we'll wrap up this segment and this show. And I know that this is something that you've talked about a lot. I know you talk about this a lot in college basketball with teams trying to get to 20 or 25 wins, something like that. By my count, we've got 24 teams in college football right now that have 5 wins on the season. So, of course, a 6th win would mean bowl eligibility. We've got some very bad teams here that are looking to pick up a 7th loss here this week, but I know that's an angle that you'll kind of have your eye on here as we go throughout November. Those teams that either get to bowl eligibility or get to a point where a bowl game is just not going to happen.
Adam, I have been harping that not all losses are created equal, and I appreciate you bringing it up. You know, when you are going through your August workouts and you're practicing and you are just putting your heart and soul into preparing for the season, not everyone has goals to win the national championship. Not everyone has goals to get to the playoffs. Not everyone even has goals to win their conference. But I would say 99% of the teams have a goal to get to a bowl. So if you are off a loss and it's your 7th loss, you cannot reach your goal of a winning record. You cannot reach your goal of being 500 or better. You can no longer go to a bowl. It's oftentimes coaches get fired. It's oftentimes that the team switches its game plan and starts going to young, inexperienced players to prepare for next year. I have 2 systems to fit into that mold. If you play on a home dog of 8 or more that's off their 8th loss, off their 7th loss, so they lost their last game and they now have 7 losses, playing against them, you've gone 29-13, 69%. Last week, there was one play. It was Rice. This week, there is one play. It's UMass. Likewise, if you play against an away dog of 10 or more, that's off their 7th loss, 48-31-2, 62%. Last week, it went 2-0, New Mexico State and Akron. This week, there's one team, Old Dominion. So it's that simple. You're playing on your 7th loss, and you're playing a much better opponent because you're either a home dog of 8 or more, or you're a double-digit away dog. You're playing a superior foe that's likely to have a winning record because of the line, and those teams fade down the stretch. So it's, you know, I'm not going to say it's an automatic play-on for me, but it's certainly a team that I put right over in the mix and then really have to talk myself out of it to not play against these teams. That's how strong I feel that is.
Well, we'll have to try to keep track of that here as we go throughout the month of November with Rolf Michaels, professional handicapper over at wagertalk.com. What's going on over there at the website right now, Rolf?
Well, you know, again, college basketball around the corner. I'm like a kid in a candy store doing a guide. I want to put this in there. I want to put this in there. I want to put this in there. Well, I'm finally running out of time where I just got to get the damn guide up. So, like I said, it'll be up either tomorrow or Thursday, so make sure you check it out. You're going to have, again, a one-page guide that's going to be able to give you last year's strength of schedule, last year's final power ratings, their stats with points per game and rebounds per game, their 247 ranking for last year, their 247 ranking for this year. Because in college basketball, that ranking is as important as any. I'm going to have Torvik's numbers in there and Ken Palm's numbers in there. And again, at one glance, you're going to be able to at least know the expectations of that team moving forward. So when you're looking at those 145 lines next Tuesday, you're going to have an idea if that line is right or wrong.
Well, make sure you follow Rolf on Twitter, as I mentioned, at CalSportsLV, and check out his work over at WagerTalk.com. Rolf, we appreciate your time as always, buddy. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk to you again next week.
Can't wait. Next week, college hoops next Tuesday.
There you go. There's Rolf Michaels again, professional handicapper over at WagerTalk.com. Coming up on our Wednesday edition of Bang the Book Radio, we'll chat with another Wager Talk pro. That is professional handicapper Brian Leonard. Then we'll also talk with VSiN host Wes Reynolds. We'll do NFL, college football, a little bit of golf, maybe some college basketball, some NBA, a bunch of stuff going on here. We'll try to tackle all of it with you on tomorrow's show. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.